Welcome to the second in our six-part series on the Rambam's Hilchos Avodah Zarah. Last week we talked about Lahavinu Lahoros, the issue of whether one is allowed to learn Avodah Zarah for any purpose. And we talked about Avodah Zarah as well as Minus that came from the Rambam's second parak in Hilchos Avodah Zarah. This week we move on to the third parak and the issue of Tikroves Avodah Zarah. A carbon brought for Avodah Zarah, and I thought we would do it in the context of what was a popular case 10 years ago, the issue of the Hindu Shetal, or the Tirupati Shetal, as I've titled it here, named for the city in which from which the hair came. For the next 2 weeks after this, Rabbi Zirin will be giving the shiur on further parts in the Rambam Hilchos Avodah Zarah. Then I'll come back for one, then he's got one, all told for six. That should take us up until Hanukkah break. So, history of the issue, even though it's true that I think most of us became aware of the Hindu Shetal discussion probably 10, 12 years ago, the truth of the matter is that, number one, the issue was first raised in 1968, and number two, the issue was first raised in Toronto in 1968. Rav Nachum Rabinovich, when he was the rabbi of Clinton Park, I believe, actually wrote the original tshuva on it. And I brought you just a piece of this in Source Aleph from the Psak from the Beis Din in Yerushalayim, where they mentioned it. Apirsum hama oer harishon be'inyan, the first one to call people's attention to this. Haya bi'archon kol Torah. It was in a journal called Kol Torah. Nisan tafshin chafches. Shom kosev Rav Nachum Rabinovich mi Toronto. Vizela Shono, and this is what Rabbi Rabinovich said. Kol shakiluach nasa l'shem akum. If the shaving of the hair, the cutting of the hair, is done for the sake of Avodah Zarah, lo yehe ela kibitzira didami lizvicha, it may be compared specifically to the cutting of grapes for Avodah Zarah, which is like the shechting of an animal. Vaharehu tikroves, it is considered a carbon for Avodah Zarah, v'ne'esar, and therefore the hair is prohibited. That's the conclusion, in fact, that the Rabbi Rabinovich came to. Get a big gang walk in the door. His conclusion was that, in fact, the hair is usur, and therefore you're not able to make a shetel out of it. So, in order to address this, and in order to understand the issue in light of the Rambam, we're going to have to do two things. One thing that we're going to have to do is we're going to need to understand the Metzius. What in the world was this about? What was going on at this temple, and what was the source for the hair that was being used for these sheilach? That's question number one. And then number two, we're going to have to pare down the issues, trim them, you might say, in order to get down to the one issue that we're going to deal with in the context of the Rambam. So I brought you in Beis the description by Rav Sternbach in his Tshuvos van Hagos, where he wrote about this issue and he explained what he understood to be the case. He says, Hinei Bahodu, in Hodu, in India, Dasam ha'atika, their ancient religion, hamachuna Hindu, hina mamash avodah zarah ki bimei kedem. He says, that's real avodah zarah, like he says, the good old days. He doesn't say the word good, but he says, like the old days. One of the ways they worship is by bringing hair as a gift before the idol, by cutting their hair for the idol. Now, mind you, this is his version of what's going on. We're going to find out it's not so clear cut. That was not an intended pun. It's not so clear cut, but that's the way he presents it. And here's what they do. He says the Hindus believe that hair is the greatest, highest form part of the human being. And especially for Hindu women, where it's a matter of beauty. It's not only beauty, sorry. That's their pride. They only cut their hair as part of this ritual of offering it to the gods. They won't cut their hair otherwise.
Ubederach klal, kasher rotzah ha-Hindi levakesh bakasha retzinit min ha-Elil, when a Hindu woman wants to make some serious request of their idol, know there who, she'im tismali bakasha so yavo l'tirupati shuma kamoshal ha-Elil v'yakriv shamesaro. He says, if they want something from their God, they promise that they're going to go sacrifice the hare. Now, Sternbach goes back and forth in masculine and feminine here. It seems clear that we're talking about women cutting their hair for the sheitel, but it could be that men did the same ritual, or it could be that men would promise their wives' hair for the idol. You think back to the Egel, right? And the men trying to get their wives' rings to make the gold of the Egel. So they would promise that they would sacrifice the hair for the idol, and he says, "Rivavos no havlehem, rivavos no shov, and no sheim al yedei pulchanzeh." They believe that tens of thousands of people have been rescued from harm by doing this. Umeot milyonim mamash ma'aminim be'amunat tefelazu. He says, "You have hundreds of millions of people who believe in this." Ubaofen mimutsa. Midei yom biyomo ki 25,000 ish makrivim es sarosehem le'elil anim tzosham. He says on an average day about 25,000 people are having a haircut there. This is very good business. Mitoch ki 50,000 ish shepoktim es hamakom, about half the people who show up. Ve'av sheyodim heim shasaros nimkaros la'acham ikein ein ze makriya lahem. They all know that it's going to go get sold. Nonetheless, they do this. It doesn't bother them. Because the essential worship is in the haircut itself. They don't care what's going to happen with the hair afterwards. Ulfanim. He says originally what they did was they just had the haircut and then they would throw out the hair. And that was it. And then in recent years, Shania Bikush Gadol Shuk Hasayar, there was a great market for hair. Hechelu Mochrim Esaros Hanashim, they started to sell the women's hair, La'achar Hamiyun, after first sorting it to identify the best parts. L'sochrim Meshavke Sayar Avur Yitzra Peyot. He says, then they started selling it to merchants, middlemen, who had provided for the making of wigs. Shemiyavim Osam L'Mizrach HaRachok, they bring it to the Far East, Europe, so debris and so on. So the version of things as described by Sternbach is the hair is a carbon for the Avodah Zarah. Now, Sternbach notwithstanding, there are those who disagree both in our sources and in their sources regarding what they're trying to accomplish by doing this. I brought you a Wikipedia piece here which gives you a little bit of background on what they're doing. I'm not going to go through it. I just brought it there for the sake of completeness. But there are multiple versions of this, as we're going to see shortly, that are going to affect the way that the halacha views the status of the hair. So Rav Yashiv originally heard this in 1990, and he investigated it, and he said mutter. His answer was the hair was fine. Then he received new reports about what was going on in 2004, and he said it's not fine. Now I understand that it's actually prohibited. So there are a number of factors here. As I said, we're going to have to slim down the list of factors we're going to be looking at and issues that we're going to be studying. One issue that's involved is the question of whether what Rav Sternbach said about Hinduism is actually correct. We have more sheets here. Thank you. Whether what Rav Sternbach said is actually correct when he said that Hinduism is galat avodah zarah, that's really the old school type of idolatry. And the reason why it's not so clear is noted by a researcher by the name of Annette Yoshiko Reed, who has written quite a bit on halacha. And I brought it there in the source that's numbered one. It's actually the fourth source on your sheet. Where she, I don't know whether she's Jewish or not. Don't know. But her statement is that, as you see here, laws forged in antiquity to deal with Jewish life in the Roman Empire were redeployed to tackle new questions raised by the unintentional encounter with Vaishnavite worship in India among relatively closed communities of Haredi Jews. In other words, we never had to think about Hindus before. When we thought in terms of the definition of Avodah Zarah, so we thought of Greeks and Romans. We thought of idols. That was the way we imagined Avodah Zarah.
zara to be, and that's the halachic terminology that we use. However, the truth of the matter is, when you get to some of these Eastern religions, you have people who conceive of a form of worship which is localized around the physical object, but they don't believe the physical object is God. And if you press them on it, many of them will say, there's one God who has no physical form who created the world. It's certainly not Judaism. But on the other hand, the question of whether that qualifies as avodah zarah is actually quite complex. So, yeah, even though it's true that when you read the Chuvos on this issue, it's sort of taken as a given, well, of course Hinduism is avodah zarah, you have to know that it's not straightforward. A second problem in this is the lack of clarity of what exactly they're trying to accomplish when they do this. If you take a look at source number 2, this is from a fellow named Benjamin Fleming, who is Jewish. And Fleming writes, the worshipper who wishes to fulfill a vow has his or her hair cut as part of a broader purificatory, I think that's how you pronounce that, purificatory process prior to approaching the idol. The process also involves bathing to remove dirt and dead skin and so on. These are treated as remnants of the worshipper and hence categorically impure. Similarly, the worshipper does not have anything to do with the hair once it is cut off the head. Rather, the routine of cutting the hair is part of preliminary purification. And the remnant hair is gathered in warehouses away from where ritual activities are performed, although admittedly still within the temple grounds upon the sacred mountain. In other words, Fleming's point is to look at it exactly the opposite of what Rav Sternbach said. Rav Sternbach said they're cutting the hair as a gift for their God, whereas Fleming is arguing the way they do it is they cut it outside of their temple complex in order to purify themselves before going in.
Like cut fingernails on Friday.
Yeah, like cutting your fingernails before Shabbos. This is a means of cleansing themselves. You go in a mikvah, you're not worshiping the Tumah. So it's just the opposite, he says. And if you look at the top of the next page, he says, how can we explain then the confusion that arose surrounding the status of a hair as offering both among the Orthodox Jewish observers and in the media coverage? I'm shocked that the media didn't know what was going on. Okay. The rulings about the hair were based on a variety of first-hand accounts from Hindus as well as first-hand observation of the rite. When asked, Hindu priests in North America and devotees in India consistently describe the hair as an offering to the god, whether in the sense of a self-sacrifice or in the sense of a gift. No mention was made by any Hindu insiders of any impurity associated with the hair. And so he goes on to try to explain why within their culture there would be confusion, but basically of machlokes among the Hindus. You have some of them saying that we do this as a gift for our God, and some of them saying that we do this to cleanse ourselves of the hair, which is dirty, before we go in. So now you need to know what the belief of the Hindu was, the Hindu from whom you got the hair for the shetel. So that's a whole other issue that has to be resolved. Yeah.
I mean, the Wikipedia has quite a detailed description of what's going on.
Well, I don't know how many Hindus read Wikipedia. I don't know what the Hindu version of Wikipedia is.
It gives you a whole story. He didn't make it out, this story, obviously.
No. But on the other hand, we know quite well, if you were to ask, and this is, okay, add as many lahavdils as you wish to the following statement, but if you were to ask a Jew why we do some fairly common, fairly standard practices, why do we open the door at the Seder, right? You will be surprised, maybe you won't be surprised, at the range of answers that you will get from people as to why we do things. We have all sorts of different ideas. So it's not shocking to think that you have two different approaches to this ritual among their rank and file. But that's a second issue that really has to be resolved. The third issue that has to be resolved is a point that Rav Sternbach made, and Rav Elyashiv visits as well. I brought you Rav Elyashiv here in the source numbered Gimel, and that is, I'm not going to read it inside because there's so much we have to see that is of what we're talking about. I just want you to realize that there are other issues involved as well. But Rav Elyashiv here says, in his 1990 tshuva, where he was matir, where he allowed the hair, he says they're selling it commercially. Clearly it's not a gift for their God if they're selling it commercially. Right? What kind of a ritual would that be? That which you dedicate as a gift to your God, you don't then take and make a profit on. So his argument in 1990 was that it's not a problem. Again, he reversed himself 14 years later. And then there's a separate problem that I brought you in source Dalit from the Rama, where the Rama says there's a separate issue. Even if this is not an offering for the Avodah Zarah, you have a separate problem in that by buying it, you are funding the Avodah Zarah. Right? You're paying money, which will then go to the temple in Tirupati. Now, the truth of the matter is that that's not necessarily so. Because how are shekels sold? How do you, what's the system for bringing this hair to market? It's like any other product. Middleman after middleman after middleman, right? There's somebody buying the hair from the temple in Tirupati. That person is turning around and shipping it to somebody else on another shore who may be part of his company, may not be part of his company, but they're in turn selling it to the shekelmacher, who then in turn is turning it into a shekel and maybe selling that shekel personally, or may even be selling that shekel through a retailer. So the money that I spend on it is not necessarily going to fund the temple in Tirupati. It's going to fund the retirement of some middle person somewhere along the lines. Is there a grama element? That's a very good question. We generally assume not. For example, when we deal, the Rambam deals with the issue of buying stolen goods. So the Rambam's concern when you buy stolen goods is lifnei iver. That if you buy stolen goods from somebody who engages in stealing them, then you are encouraging him to now sell, you know, buy, to steal more things. He doesn't deal with it as grumma of the theft. And there's no lifnei iver here, I think. I mean, you're talking about a major market. The one shekel that you purchase isn't necessarily the lifnei iver that's causing them to do it. They have plenty of customers. So I think that would be hard, especially because we are not their sole market. It's not as though all the Hindus are cutting their hair for the sake of the Jewish market for Shaylach. You talk about 25,000 people cutting their hair every day. So these are all questions, plus you have to add in questions about nullifying Avodah Zarah in a mixture, and how do you know where the hair came from, layer upon layer. But the point that I want to address is the central question of Tigroves. Let's say that it actually is a religious ceremony. Except that it's a religious ceremony, and except that they are cutting the hair as a holy act to dedicate the hair for the Avodah Zarah before they then, you know, go and sell it. Does that hair become prohibited when they cut it at Tirupati? This is going to require that we learn a Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Nun and Aleph. And the Gemara there is going to deal with a series of different kinds of rituals. Then once we see that Gemara, we're going to see how the Rambam paskins out of that Gemara and the apparent self-contradiction. And then the resolution of that self-contradiction by the Or Sameach will bring us back to the Shetel. So it's a long way around, but we have to really spend a lot of time just getting the facts down in terms of the Gemara in order to understand what the problem is and then what the resolution is. Clear? Good? I'm also going to pass around the sign-in sheet because I see that we have some people this week who are not on the email list for the shiur. If you want to receive the source sheets in advance, you could put down your name and email address. I think everyone at this table is already on. But if you want to pass that back for anyone who's not currently receiving it and wishes to do so. Okay. So we're going to be working from the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which I gave you in source Vav on the sheet. But before that, I'm going to give you an introduction via a Rashi that's on that Gemara to the basic principles of liability for acts of Avodah Zarah. If one performs an act for the Avodah Zarah, well, there are a few different sort of layers to this, or a few different possibilities. One possibility is that a person performs an action which is normally done in the Beis Hamikdash for Hashem and does that for the Avodah Zarah. So a person takes ketores, incense, and puts it on an altar. That will be an example of an act that's normally done for Hashem, and he's now doing it for the Avodah Zarah. Then there's another possibility. You do an action which is an Avodah Zarah action. Has nothing to do with us. We would never do it. However, the Ovdei Avodah Zarah do that action for their God, and a Jew does that for them. And then you have a third possibility. Freestyle. A Jew does something that Jews normally do not do for Hashem, and Ovdei Avodah Zarah do not normally do for their Avodah Zarah, but you made it up. And then the question is, what will be, will there be, in fact, any liability for doing so? So if you take a look at source Hay, he just pulled out of the Rashi there. He says, Kol Avodos Shebifnim, and he's basing himself on a Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Samach. He says, Kol avodos shebifnim, all the avodos that we normally do in the Beis HaMikdash, she'avad bahen avodas kochavim, if one performs them for the avodah zarah, bein darka bekach, bein she'ein darka bekach, whether the avodah zarah is normally worshipped that way or not, chayav, you are liable. You can't do the avodos of the Beis HaMikdash for the avodah zarah. Then he also says, v'davar she'eino ke'ein pinim, if the act is not ke'ein pinim, what does ke'ein pinim mean? Sorry? Like what's done in the Beis HaMikdash, but there are two particular resemblances that we have to talk about, and this is a specific one. There are two different types of resembling the avodah done in the Beis HaMikdash. It's sort of like Hilchos Shabbos in a way, and maybe I'll start from Hilchos Shabbos because that's an easier way to make the comparison. We know that the laws of Shabbos and the malachas of Shabbos are modeled on the malachas that were done in the construction slash maintenance of the Mishkan, and then later we have the Beis HaMikdash. However, in order for an act to be prohibited as a malacha, deoraisa, it has to have a particular resemblance to those. It has to resemble it in what way? Has to resemble it in method, and it has to resemble the malacha in goal, in what you want to have happen at the end, in what you're trying to accomplish. So for example, digging a hole. You can dig a hole because you want whatever's in the ground, you're digging out the dirt to use it, or you can dig a hole for storage purposes. The malacha in the Mishkan is digging a hole in order to store things in the hole. If I dig a hole on Shabbos, not to store things in the hole, but because I want the dirt, am I chayav? I am, but only midrabanan. I'm only liable midrabanan, not del raisa. Why? It looks the same as the act you did for the Beis HaMikdash, for the Mishkan. Looks the same, but your goal is different. Ditto for the issue of method. If I do what they do, let's say bishul, although that may not be the best example, but let's say I cook, but I cook in a way that is unusual, it's not the normal way of cooking, also it can become a derabanan. Maybe even less, again, cooking is unique, maybe I shouldn't bring cooking as an example, but my point is it has to resemble it in terms of the way you do it and the goal. The same thing is going to be true when it comes to avodah zarah. There are different ways to resemble or not resemble the act of avodah zarah. One is in terms of the method, and the other is in terms of the object. Meaning, we say, I'm going to give you an example that's going to come up in the Gemara. One of the main avodos that we perform is zrikas hadam, throwing the blood that's going to go onto the mizbeach. What if I, instead of throwing blood, throw milk on the avodah zarah? I throw milk on the altar for the avodah zarah. Is that like what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash? Yes or no? No, why not?
Because blood tends to substitute milk for blood.
Because milk is in blood. Hey, there's actually a Gemara about that. But all right, fine. I'm not Karvanasa caller. Fine. Maybe I wasn't the best example either. But milk and blood are not the same thing. What if I throw a stick? Is that considered to be like what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash? No. And we'll see more about why it's not actually when we get to it in the Gemara. Shechita is an act that goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. What if instead of Shechita, I cut a stick? Is that like what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash? Well, you're cutting something, right? What if instead of cutting a stick, what if I cut an animal, but it's not an animal that will be eligible in the Beis HaMikdash? These are all issues of resemblances that we have to work our way through. And what Rashi is saying here is if it doesn't resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash precisely, then if darka bekach, if that's the way the Avodah Zarah is normally worshipped, then you're chayav. Even though it doesn't resemble what went on in the Beis HaMikdash, that's what they do for their idol. So, Marcolis is a good example. Right, Marcolis, they take, it's like Stonehenge Marcolis. They take two vertical stones, and they layer a slab across the top, and that's a Marcolis, and they throw stones on top of the Marcolis. It's the sort of thing that kids would probably do in high school. But that's what they do for the Avodah Zarah. So, that doesn't resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash, but it's darka b'kach. That's why you worship the Avodah Zarah. So therefore, you're going to be chayav for doing so. Ain darka b'kach, but if it's not the way of the Avodah Zarah, and it doesn't resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash, potter, you're going to be exempt from liability. So we know this going in,
that it has to, in order to be chayav, it has to resemble, it either has to be like what you do in the Beis HaMikdash, or it has to be what they do for themselves, or potentially, if it resembles what they do, and it resembles what we do, even if it's not precise, then one will also be chayav. So now let me ask you a question, before we see the Gemara. Of these options, how would you classify haircutting at Tirupati? Does it resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash?
No.
No? You sure? There are cuttings that we do shechita.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now the question is it the same as shechita? Clearly it's not the same object.
We do
giluach of the nazir, but that's not for a carbon. Even though we burn the hair of the nazir. Sorry?
It's not alive.
It's not alive. Right? It's not something that is alive. So that may be an argument.
Cutting the
Kohen's hair for when?
Every 30 years.
No, that we cut the Kohen's hair, but we don't do that on the compound of the Beis HaMikdash. And again, the Nazir, we cut the hair of the Nazir, and we even burn it, but it's not a carbon. Sorry?
Isn't it part of the Bishul of the
El-Nazir? Yeah, it's the part of the Bishul of the El-Nazir, but it's not a carbon in its own right. If you lost the hair, if the hair blew away, you wouldn't disqualify the carbon. So, this is something we have to keep in our minds as we go along. We still haven't discussed the question, which is going to be directly relevant for the Shekel, which is, even if this is an act of Avodah Zarah that we say is Asur, does that mean the hair is going to become Asur Bahana? Does that mean you can't benefit from the hair? So that's where we have to go with this as well. So look now in the Gemara in Source Vav. I broke down the sugya in a way that I hope will make it easier for people who are not holding in Maseches Avodah Zarah. Okay, I broke it down into four segments. So the first part of the Gemara, Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, Avodas Kochavim Sha'ovdin Osa V'Makel. If you have an Avodah Zarah that is normally worshipped with sticks, they bang sticks, they have a drum circle, who knows what. They worship the Avodah Zarah with sticks. Shavar makel b'fanel, chayav. If you break a stick in front of the Avodah Zarah, liable. Zarak makel b'fanel, patur. If you throw a stick in front of it, you are patur. Chayav if you break a stick, patur if you throw a stick. Why would I make any distinction? What's the difference? Why should you be chayav for breaking a stick, but not for throwing a stick?
That's the next line.
Nope. Neither of them are darka b'kach. Well, the next line is the question. Amar le Abaye l'Rava. Abaye asks Rava. He says, Maishna shavar. Why are you chayav for breaking a stick? Davale ke'ein zivicha. Is it because it's like shechita? When you break the stick, we want to say that is close enough to shechita that you're going to be chayav. Zark nami avale ke'ein zrika. Well, then throwing the stick is like zrika. What's the difference between the two? Why is cutting a stick like cutting an animal's neck? But throwing a stick is not like throwing dam. That's Abaye's challenge. It says Abaye asks Rava this question. The truth of the matter is that in the Gemara normally, Abaye doesn't ask Rava questions. Right? Rava is junior. Abaye asks Rava questions. And I'm kind of surprised that Masoras HaShas does not jump in here and say, Tzarech Lomar Rava. It feels like it ought to be. Nonetheless, this is the girsa we have. So Omar Le, Rava responds, Ba'ina Zrika Mishtaberes Veleka. Rava says you require that the Zrika actually break. It has to be something that scatters. What this debate is about between Abaye and Rava is the definition of the act of Zrika. When we deal with Zrika's Hadam, what's the definition of Zrika? Does Zrika mean I transported an item from point A to point B through the air? Or does Zrika also mean, in addition to it being transported through the air, the drops scatter at the end? There has to be some form of scattering as well. And Rava defends Rav by saying that the landing is part of Zrika. Zrika is not only transit through the air, Zrika is also the way the object lands. You follow? Sorry? In a sense, Akira and Hanacha are part of the definition of Zrika. It's not called Zrika without it. I think I might stand and use the shtender because I can't see people in the back. That's the idea. That in fact, we would say that throwing it is not the definition of growing is not simply you transported the item from point A to point B, but actually that it landed in a particular way. That's the way that Rava understands it, and that's the way that Rava explains Rav. Clear? So we have a basic machlokas that we're seeing between Abaye and Rava about the definition of Zrika, with a practical application being, if I throw a stick or any other solid object and it lands intact, am I going to be chayav? That's what he says. And then Esve, the Gemara asks, well then what about the following? Safas lotsoa, oshen nasach lefaneha avit shomei raglayim chayav. This is kind of gross. But if they, what if they were to pour out soa excrement in front of the avodah zara? They would pour meraglayim out in front of it. We know the rule is that they are chayav for doing so. So bishlama avit shomei meraglayim ikazrika mishtaberes. When you're dealing with meraglayim, I understand it breaks apart. You pour it, it scatters. That's fine. But he says, let's soa, my zrika mishtaberes ika, but what about with soa? It's a solid object. So he answers, but soa lacha, it's not always a solid object. The shilshul is the case. Parenthetically, Rashi tells us, no, we're talking about an avodah zara that normally uses such materials. There still has to be a resemblance to the ma'is avodah zara, but that's a side note in this discussion. Ayin sham baal peor. But the point for our purposes is that we're highlighting the fact that it has to resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash, but we seem to be somewhat loose, according to Rav, about what constitutes a resemblance. It is sufficient for me to break a stick and say that's like Shechita. It is sufficient for me to throw a liquid that scatters and say that's like Zrikas Hadam. And milk apparently will count for the same purpose. Clear? You see where we're going towards hair and shchita, obviously. Okay. That's the first piece of the Gemara. Then we get a machlokas in the Gemara regarding what's called ke'im panim. And that takes us back to the question of how closely something has to resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. Lema kitanoi. Let's say this is actually a machlokas tanoi. We learned. Shachat lachagav. If you shecht a locust, a grasshopper, in front of the Avodah Zarah, Rabbi Yehuda mechayev v'chachamim potrim. Rabbi Yehuda says, liable for shechting the locust, and the chacham say, no, you're potter for shechting the locust. What's Rabbi Yehuda's logic, would I assume? What's Rabbi Yehuda's logic in saying chayev for shechting the locust?
Similar to
And what's the argument of the Chachamim?
Not similar
to Shechita. My love, Akamiflagi, isn't this the debate? Demar Savar Amrinam Kein Zavicha. One says it just has to resemble an act of Shechita, and it does, and therefore you're Chayav. Umar Savar Lo Amrinam Kein Zavicha, like Kein Panim. And the other one says you need more than just resembling the physical act. You also need ke'ein panim, and now we come back to define ke'ein panim more closely. Ke'ein panim means not only does it resemble the action, but the item involved resembles the item used in the Beis HaMikdash. That's the other requirement of ke'ein panim. Locust doesn't look like a sheep. Locust doesn't look like a whatever, you know, ram, bull, whatever you want to talk about them using, and therefore you won't be chayav for it. Is the issue here how closely it has to resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash? In which case, Rav's statement that it doesn't need to resemble it perfectly, that cutting the stick is sufficient, for example, Rav's statement is actually subject to a machlokes tanoim. That will be the upshot. To which the Gemara says, "Lo, not necessarily." I could tell you that everybody disagrees with Rav. Rav is too strict. When Rav says cutting the stick is like shchita, when Rav says that throwing any liquid is like zrika, we don't agree with him. We say that ke'ein pinim, the resembling what's in the Beis HaMikdash, means it actually has to resemble the objects. Then why should anybody say you're chayav for shechting the locust? V'sha'ani chagav hol v'tzavaro doma l'tzavar behema. Because locusts are different. Because the neck of the locust resembles the neck of a beast, of an animal. So I actually gave a shir on this. I give a Gemara about a Zara shir at the Bayit on Shabbos afternoon. So I brought in for them. I should have really brought it on the sheet. Diagrams to show you the structure of the neck of a bull and the structure of the neck of a grasshopper. And obviously the scale is different. And the bone structure inside is obviously different. Nonetheless, the way the animal holds its head in juxtaposition to the body, and the way that the grasshopper's head is positioned in juxtaposition of the body, from that pure external standpoint, there is enough of a resemblance that you could understand why somebody would say, yeah, you cut the animal's neck, you cut the grasshopper's neck, it's just a matter of a difference of scale. You could see why somebody would have said it once you look at the pictures.
Locusts or grasshoppers, if we don't have shechita at all.
Correct. We do not have shechita for kosher locusts. That is 100% true. I would not draw any conclusions or any similarities in the context of Hilchos Kashrus. That is absolutely true.
No, that makes a big difference.
Yeah.
I mean, the structure might be the same, but you don't even have shechita by... It's like
right, no, shechita is completely irrelevant to grasshoppers. That's true. Just this looks more like an animal than a stick does. That's all. And it's a live thing, which, you know, you add to it. So what emerges now, and, you know, again, I'm recapping a lot because this is more of just reading through a sugya than we usually end up doing in this, in the shir. So I want to make sure that everybody's with it. What we end up saying at this stage is actually that it's possible that everybody disagrees with Rav. Rav says that you are chayav as long as your act resembles the act that's done in the Beis HaMikdash, even if the object is different. The stick, the tzoah, whatever. Whereas we're now saying both Tanoim, both the Chachamim, and Rabbi Yehuda, regarding the grasshopper, they may position themselves against Rav and say, you're not chayiv unless it actually resembles what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash in action and in terms of object. But now we get to the Isser Hanah. Now we get to the issue of whether you are allowed to benefit from an item that was used in the Beis HaMikdash. So that's the part headed to Grovis. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Baravu, Amar Rav. Avodas kochavim sha'ovdin osa b'makel. If you have an avodah zara that's worshipped with sticks, shavar makel b'faneh ha'chayav v'neh eseres. If you break a stick in front of it, you are liable. And the stick becomes asur. Zarak makel b'faneh ha'chayav v'neh eseres. If you throw the makel, you throw the stick, you're chayav, but the stick does not become prohibited. Now this is Rav talking. So again, Rav doesn't require a close resemblance of what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. She doesn't care that a stick doesn't look like blood, a stick doesn't look like the carbon. That doesn't bother Rav in the least. You're chayav because the action resembles what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash, but he distinguishes between breaking the stick, the result of breaking a stick, and the result of throwing a stick. He says when it comes to breaking a stick, the stick used for the act is tikroves. It's like it's an offering for the avodah zara, and you're not allowed to benefit from it. When it comes to throwing the stick, though, since throwing it doesn't really resemble zrikas hadam, therefore it doesn't become asur. In other words, someone could pick up that stick and go home and use it. You follow? In other words, what we're really saying is it's possible for an act to be prohibited as an act of avodah zara. And yet, for the object you used, you gave to the Avodah Zarah, to be mutter in the end. Or to compare it to the Sheitel case. It's possible to argue you're not allowed to cut your hair at Tirupati in front of the temple, and yet the hair remains mutter. Even if they cut it there and intend it for the Avodah Zarah and everything else, the hair could still be mutter. That's the distinction. What's the distinction predicated upon? Does this resemble an act that's done in the Beis HaMikdash, or does it not resemble an act that's done in the Beis HaMikdash? This makes a lot of sense, this distinction. Because there is a principle of Hakdasha. What is Hakdasha? What is Hakdasha? What does it mean to be Makdish something? You did it, sorry? Not separate it, you're dedicating it, right? You dedicate something for use in the Beis HaMikdash, that's Hakdasha. When it comes to the Beis HaMikdash, you dedicate something for the Beis HaMikdash, it's now off limits, it's now dedicated, that's it. Avodah Zarah, if somebody says that X item is going to be a carbon for the Avodah Zarah, it's not off limits. There's no such thing as Hakdasha for an Avodah Zarah. So what we're saying here is, in the context of serving the Avodah Zarah, if the act you perform doesn't resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash, the item you use, the item you dedicated, is mutter. it only becomes asur if it also resembles that which goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. Clear? That's the idea. So again, we have a debate as to what's going to be asur. Rav says it's asur if it resembles the action that goes on in the Beis HaMikdash, even if the item isn't the same. The Chachamim say the item has to be the same or awfully similar as well. Within that debate, does the hair resemble a karban when you cut the hair? No. The action may resemble, but the object doesn't. Therefore, those who disagree with Rav are going to say the hair is fine. Even within Rav, we're going to say, what's the status of the hair? Does this resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash? Really? That's going to be your second layer question. Last piece of the Gemara. Ke'en Pnim, the last piece of the Gemara, and then we shift into the Rambam. Amar Rabbi Avo, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Avo quotes Rabbi Yochanan to say, Minayin lezoveach behema balas mum la'avodas kochavim shu patur. How do you know that if you shecht an animal that has a blemish for avodah zarah, you are exempt, your patur? Shneimar, the pasuk says, Zoveach lo Elohim yocharam biltil Hashem levado. I wrote in Chol, so anybody would know this isn't Shemos. This is just Elohim, meaning the avodah zarah. If you shecht for an avodah zarah, one who shechts for an avodah zarah is to be destroyed. You only shecht for Hashem. Lo asra tara ela kein pinim. It's only asur if it resembles what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. So if you shecht a blemished animal for the avodah zarah, potter, you're not going to be chayav. So we've now discussed a whole set of cases. We've talked about throwing sticks. We've talked about breaking sticks. We've talked about pouring tzawa in front of the avodah zarah. We've talked about shechting a locust. We've talked about shechting a blemished animal. This brings us to the Rambam, and that's source Zion. The Rambam writes first in Halacha Beis. Avodos harbe kavu ovde kochavim l'chotzelem v'tzelem l'chotzura v'tzura. He says there are all sorts of forms of worship of avodah zarah. U'l'chotzura v'tzura. Sorry, avodah zeh ena kavodah zeh. Each one is worshipped uniquely and differently. U'v'nei zeh ha'inyan tzrichin beistin leida darchei ha'avodos. And therefore the beistin has to know how things are worshipped. She'im soklin ovde kochavim ad she'yedu she'zoi derech avodaso. You can't punish somebody unless you know that that's how it's worshipped. This goes back to the shir last week, right? We discussed whether you're allowed to learn avodah zarah, to learn how they worship. And the answer was, we said, yes, you are allowed to for practical purposes, although the Rambam didn't say explicitly that you're allowed to do so. This is as close as you get to explicit when the Rambam says, based in needs to know. Halacha Gimel. He says, "Va'azhara shel avodos elu v'kayotze b'en huma shekasev v'lo sa'avdeim." The prohibition against these avodos is when the Torah says, "Do not serve them." V'med dvar ma'amurim. When is this true? Dot dot dot. Halacha dalid. Our sugya. Safas latzoa. If you pour out tzoa in front of the avodah zarah, oshen nisech la'avid shel meraglayim, or you pour out the meraglayim, chayav, you will be liable. Okay, you pour out this stuff in front of the avodah zarah, you're going to be chayav. Go back into the Gemara. Did the Gemara say that you'd be chayav for doing this?
Well, if it's the way to do it.
Assuming that it's the way that they do it, but then you're going to be chayav. In other words, the Rambam is paskining like this brisa. Right? The Rambam is, he's following the brisa. We're good so far. One is going to be chayav, assuming they used tzoa in their worship. Shachat lachagav. You shech the grasshopper for it. Patur, you're exempt from liability. Elam genaisa avodas abakach, unless that's how they worship by shechting grasshoppers. Vechem shachal labehim mechuseres eger patur. If it has a blemish, also you'll be exempt from liability. Elam genaisa derech avodas abakach, unless that's the normal means of worship. Shechting a baal mum or shechting a locust, he says patur. Is that like our Gemara? It's like the Chachamim regarding the locust, right? And regarding the baal mum. We also said Pater. The Rambam is in line with the Gemara. Then he writes, Avodas kochavim sha'ovin osa b'makel. If you worship this avodah zarah with a stick, if that's the way it's worshipped, shavar makel b'fanei achaya v'naseres. If you break a stick in front of it, you're liable, and the stick is asur. Zarach makel b'fanei achaya v'ena naseres. You throw the stick, you're liable, and it's not prohibited. She'ein zrikas hamakel ke'ein zrikas hadam, because throwing the stick is not like throwing blood. Because the stick remains as is and the blood scatters. So he says, you break a stick, you're liable and it's usur. You throw the stick, then you're liable and it's not usur. Is that like anything in our Gemara? It's like... Yeah, ostensibly it's like Rav in terms of the distinction that he made under the section called the Grovis. But in general, we said we're willing to agree with Rav about liability for the stick. So the Rambam seems to be fine. You read this Rambam and you say, okay, he's matched up nicely with the Gemara. But then you open the Ravid in Ches. Amar Avram, the Ravid says, Ein adas mekabeles kol zeh. He says, I am confused by all of this. My mind is having a hard time dealing with all of this. He says, you're twisting me around with your discussion about what resembles an avoda and doesn't resemble an avoda. You're trying to tell me that shechting a grasshopper, right, is going to be potter because it doesn't resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. Shechting an animal, a bull, a ram, but it happens to be blemished. That, he says, doesn't resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. But on the other hand, you're trying to tell me that pouring out soa resembles what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. He says, you can tell me you're poskening like the Gemara, but I don't understand what you're talking about. The resemblances are not in line. You're telling me that shefting a ram that's missing a leg is less similar to what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash than pouring tzawa in front of the Avodah Zarah. The Rabbi says, I can't accept that. I don't know what you're talking about. And if you're going to tell me that that's what the Gemara says, I'm going to tell you that actually the views in the Gemara themselves are in dispute. That's how the Rabbi solves the problem. He says, Ela marin advarm shachachamim shapotim b'shchitas chagav, Elam told those b'avodas kochavim. Umi shapota b'machuseres eder gam kein sviru lekachachamim. Avor Rabbi Yehuda b'Rav Nachman alibet deraz sviru luk Rabbi Yehuda ketana desavas. He says, the answer is that either you don't require similarity or you do require similarity. And if you require similarity, you're going to reject all of these cases. You're going to reject the locust. You're going to reject the Baal Mum. You're going to reject the Tsoa. Everything down the line. He says, the problem with you, Rambam, is that you saw all the cases in the Gemara, and you saw who seemed to win in each of the cases, and you just pulled them all out. But the truth of the matter is that the conclusions of each case are in dispute. And the way to read this is much more simply and smoothly. There's one camp that says it requires a resemblance to be chayav, and then you're exempt in all these cases down the line, including the tzawa, including the baal mum, including the chagav, all of them. And then there's a second camp that says no, that says it doesn't need to resemble it, and then you're chayav in all of these cases. The stick, the chagav, the baal mum, the tzawa, everything down the line. That's the way the Ravid wants to read it. It doesn't seem to fit the Gemara so well, but that's a beautiful way to read it, because at least it fits our minds. But the Oros HaMeach says, I'm going to give you a different answer. And this is what brings us back to the haircut. The Oros HaMeach says in Tess, Nira boru shitas rabbeinu, dim yakriv chagav o yaktir behema mechuseres ever lo'ov davodas gilulim chayot. Delo garam yisavas latsov avit shomei raglayim. He says, it seems clear that the Rambam would agree that if you brought a grasshopper on the Mizbeach, or if you burned the flesh from an animal that was a baal mum for avodah zarah, you would be liable. That's like pouring out the tzoa in front of it. All of those you'd be liable for. Rak b'shchita sha'ani, but shchita is different. Mishum d'zvicha ein rak hachana levarer chelka. He says shchita is different because shchita is an initial stage. And let me see if I can explain this outside the Oros HaMeach first, and then bless you, and then it'll be more clear. The Ravid said the answer is to distinguish between one camp and another camp about whether it has to resemble or whether it doesn't need to resemble. The opinion of the Oros HaMeach is that the distinction is between initial avodos and concluding avodos. If you're dealing with an initial avoda, which means any service which is going to be followed by another service afterwards, then the rule is it has to resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. Shechita, has to resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. However, once you get to an end stage avodah, like pouring out the stuff in front of the tzawa, in front of the avodah zara, he says when you're dealing with a final stage, in that case, our standards are stricter and you're going to be chayav. No matter what, because you're in the concluding stage avoda, therefore you're going to be chayav. And he says, when you shech the locust, or you shech the baal mum, so then there is no next step, because we don't put locusts on a mizbeach. That's it, you're done. We don't put a baal mum on the mizbeach. That's it, you're done. And therefore, that's an end stage, and therefore standards are stricter, and therefore you're going to be chayav. When they pour out the tzoa, when they pour out the meraglayim, that's an end stage. There's nothing afterwards, and therefore you're going to be chayav. That's the answer that he. That's the answer that the Or Sameach gives. The Rambam is following Rav's view on one, and the Chachamim on the other. And there are other sources you can bring. The Ibn Azal brings another source. The Piskei Din also brings another source to support this idea. But that's the key. When it comes to avoda that's being done, when it comes to the acts that are being done for the avodah zara, if what you're doing is a gemar, what you're doing is a concluding stage, then the rule is going to be that that one is going to be chayav. And that brings me to source Yud, which is the psak on this issue of the shekel. Lefi zeh, according to this, avodah zarah shavodase hi b'ha'avaras ha-se'ar. When you have an idol that's worshipped by removing the hair, shahistabrut eina achana la'aktaras ha-se'aros el gemar avodah zarah. Cutting the hair is not a preface for, it's not a preparatory stage for putting the hair on the mizbeach. El gemar avodah zarah, that's the conclusion. So that is like pouring out the tzoa in front of it. That's like breaking the stick in front of it. That's the conclusion of the avodah. There is no haktara waiting. Shekasav or Sameach, the Or Sameach wrote, "Bedas Harambam, the Hareza Kemachil avodah zara shechayot kevin shigmar avodah zara." That's like putting something on the mizbeach. That's the conclusion of the avodah, and therefore you're chayav. It's like the completion of the avodah in the Beis Hamikdash. Vilachain, and there, I'm sorry. Vehu adin b'tisparas haseyar l'avodah zarah b'tirupati shenechsheves sham lahakrava l'avodah zarah harei k'avodas hakmosh shamalav. Therefore, he says one would be chayav for this, for the hair, for cutting the hair, and the result would be that the hair would in fact be off limits. So on this basis, and again, I noted in the beginning that there are five or six different reasons or points of debate really to deal with in the context of this question. But in terms of the question of directly, you have a Gemara in Avodah Zarah that says you're only chayav in the event that what you do resembles what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. So in that context, I would have walked in and said, well, in that case, there's no discussion. The hair doesn't resemble what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. You're not cutting a living thing. The hair doesn't look like an animal. Beginning, middle, and end. That's it. And therefore, you're not going to be... The hair does not become off-limits. It's not a tikrovis. Maybe I have to discuss the Ramah. My money is going to support the Avodah Zarah. But that's it. However, because of the Or Sameach, who says it doesn't have to have a close resemblance to be Asur, if what you're talking about is the final stage of the Avodah, because of that view of the Or Sameach, that's why the Poskim in fact said that the hair that was used for Sheiklach that came from this temple in Tirupati would be prohibited. I realize this is a little more esoteric than the usual fare that we deal with. For those who are new this week, please don't get scared off. They come back next week when Rabbi Ziering will be speaking. I don't remember what his title is.
What happened? Because, I mean, we have an opinion that it's really just like a bag, right?
That is what?